Good afternoon, everyone. I call this meeting on Workforce and Business Development, Finance and Policy to order. This meeting, a hybrid meeting and remote, is being conducted to pursuant Rule 10.01. This meeting can be viewed on the House webcast. With that, I would like to ask the Committee Legislative Assistant, Mr. Badri, to now take the role.
Chair Noor.
Present.
Chair Noor present. Vice Chair Zhang.
Present.
Vice Chair Zhang present. Lead Hamilton.
Present.
Lead Hamilton present. Baker.
Here.
Baker present. Dabney. Dabney. Frankie.
Frankie present.
Frankie present. Greenman.
Greenman present.
Greenman present. Haley.
Haley present.
Haley present. Jurgens.
Jurgens present.
Jurgens present. Cagle.
Here.
Cagle present. Katiza Watun.
Present.
Katiza Watun present. Olson.
Present.
Olson present. Zhang.
Present.
Zhang present. Dabney. Dabney. Chair Noor, we have a quorum.
Members, there's a quorum present. I just wanted to remind everyone, if you have got phones, you need to put it on silence for members because the mics can pick up everything. And if you're online, please make sure you're muted. I will now entertain a motion to approve the minutes for March 30th, 2022. I see Representative Baker moves the approval of the adoption of minutes for March 30th, 2022. Any discussion? See none. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
See none. The minutes for March 30th, 2022 are now approved. Members, as we have done this work collectively, this is a moment in time that we want to make sure that we present a strong bill. And this bill that we are presenting to you today for informational hearing will have a walkthrough from our nonpartisan staff. We're all looking for a all hands on deck approach when it comes to sustainable, equitable recovery. We know that many businesses have been hit hard by the pandemic. We know that many workers have been hit hard by the pandemic. We want to have a good bill, and this is a conversation that we'll get started today. And with that, I'll turn over to the House. Do we start with fiscal analyst? Yeah. All right, we'll start with House Fiscal Analyst Ashley Eng. Welcome to the committee. Please proceed with your presentation.
Hi, thank you. I'll share my screen. And members in the hearing room, please refer to the paper as it might be easier to see. Can you see the screen?
Yes, we can.
Okay. I am referring to the workforce omnibus columns, and we'll start with line 4, total general fund spending in fiscal year 2023 is $175,889,000 and $20,500,000 in the tails. Looking at line 7.
Ms. Eng, if you can speak closer to the computer so that we can hear clearly.
Oh, yes. Is that better?
A little bit better.
Looking at line 7, there is a cancellation of workforce housing grant remaining funds, which is a revenue of $889,000 in fiscal year 2022. And on line 9, the total general fund impact for the current biennium is $175 million and $20,500,000 in the tails. Going down to the business and community development items, looking at line 27, there is $1 million in fiscal year 2023 to Minnesota Marketing and $1 million in the tails. On line 33, there is $470,000 in fiscal year 2023 and $1 million in the tails. to the Office for New Americans. Down on line 42, there is $20 million in fiscal year 2023 to the Main Street Economic Revitalization. Lines 44 and 45 are a policy change that allow access to federal funds. On line 47, there is $45 million in fiscal year 2023 and $6 million in the TAILS for Spark small business loans. On line 48, there is $25,230,000 in fiscal year 2023 towards targeted community capital projects grants. On line 49, that is the canceled funding that of $889,000 in fiscal year 2023 towards targeted community capital projects grants. On line 50, there is $20 million in fiscal year 2023 and $2 million in the TAILS to the Emerging Developer Fund. On line 51, there is $7,500,000 towards Canadian Border Counties Economic Relief Business Grants. On line 52, there is $35 million to Pandemic Relief Business Grants. On line 53, there is $800,000 in fiscal year 2023 towards Enterprise Minnesota. On line 54, there is $2 million in fiscal year 2023 towards the Center for Economic Inclusion. On line 55, there is $1 million in fiscal year 2023 towards the Coalition of Asian American Leaders. On line 56, there is $2 million in fiscal year 2023 towards the Women's Foundation of Minnesota. On line 57, there is $5 million in fiscal year 2023 and $7 million in the TAILS towards small business partnership grants and technical assistance. On line 59, there is $4 million in fiscal year 2023 towards child care grants. On line 59, there is $5 million in fiscal year 2023 and $3,500,000 in the TAILS towards redevelopment and demolitions. Looking at the workforce development area, there is on line 66, there is $1 million in fiscal year 2023 towards the New American Employment Support Services from the General Fund. And looking at the Workforce Development Fund, on line 69, there is $500,000 in fiscal year 2023 towards Teen Teamworks. On line 70, there is $20 million in fiscal year 2023 towards local workforce board grants. And on line 71, there is $5 million in fiscal year 2023 towards youth technology training. That totals for the Workforce Development Fund of $25,500,000. That concludes my presentation of the spreadsheet.
Thank you so much, Ms. Tseng, for that presentation. Members, any quick question that you have on the spreadsheet? We'll go into the details on the from the House research. All right, with that, we go to Ms. Charlene. Welcome to the committee. Please proceed with your presentation.
Chair and members, Anna Charlene, House Research. So Ms. Tseng has already gone through all the appropriations in the A22-0405 amendment. I'll now be moving on to the policy provisions, which is Article 2, beginning on page 17 of the bill. Section 1, starting on page 17, line 14, sets default expiration dates for mandatory reporting requirements if those are not already set in law. This requires that the commissioner submit to the legislature a list of all reports that would expire in the coming calendar year under this new rule. Section 2, on page 18, line 2, creates the Office of New Americans to support immigrant and refugee integration. The first two sections are both from the governor's bill. Section 3, starting on page 20, line 23, this section would include tribes and the municipalities eligible for the contamination cleanup program. This is also a governor's item. Section 4, beginning on page 20, line 27, these are changes that restructure the pay-for-performance job training incentives, including changing the amounts of awards according to the hours and pay level of the job that is gained or retained, also governor's language. Sections 5 and 6 of the bill, starting on page 23, line 4, these modify the Main Street Revitalization Grant Program to allow the commissioner to waive the matching fund requirement for grants to projects located in low-income areas. Section 7, beginning on page 24, line 22, this section creates the Spark Small Business Loan Program for statewide loans to businesses with less than 50 full-time workers. It is run through the Community Development Financial Institutions and nonprofit lenders and establishes revolving loan funds. Sections 8 and then Section 11, beginning on pages 27, line 22, and 31, line 3, these are changes that allow the state to take equity positions in new businesses and to distribute federal funds from the U.S. Treasury without it being a business subsidy. These two sections are also from the governor's bill. Section 9 and Section 18, on pages 27, line 29, and page 40, line 22, these make modifications to the Targeted Community Capital Project Grant Program to increase the maximum grant from $1,500,000 to $3 million and repeal the application of requirements under Chapter 16. Those are the requirements that usually apply to state-funded capital projects. Section 10, beginning on page 28, line 4, this section creates the Emerging Developer Fund Program to make loans to less established developers from targeted groups to pursue development projects intended to reduce racial and socioeconomic disparities. This language is based on House File 2976. Section 12, beginning on page 32, line 21, it makes modifications to the Pathways Program so that participating businesses rather than private businesses are mentioned. This is a governor's item. Section 13, beginning on page 33, line 13, makes a technical change to the Dislocated Worker Program, again from the governor's bill. Sections 14 and 15, on pages 34 and 35, make technical changes to the uniform outcome report cards, including removing program cost reporting items, again from the governor's bill. Section 16, beginning on page 36, line 16, this section creates the Canadian Border Counties Economic Relief Program, where foundations will make grants to businesses harmed by the closures of the Canadian border and the Boundary Waters canoeing area. This language is based on House File 2811. Finally, Section 17 on page 38, line 7, creates the Pandemic Relief Grants Program to make grants statewide through a lottery to businesses with less than 50 full-time workers in certain industries. And this is based on House File 4522. That is the policy provisions in this bill.
Thank you so much, Ms. Sholin. Any question on that presentation? Seeing none, I'm sure many members have good questions. So this is the D amendment to House File 4355. And for Lead Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, I had my hand up there. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Either to the fiscal analyst, or I guess this would be a question directly to the fiscal analyst. Could you remind us what the budget was that we passed last year when we agreed on the state budget to fully fund government. Could you just remind us what that was again for this committee?
Lead Hamilton, can you be more specific? Are you asking for the total budget that we passed last year?
The total budget and how much of that was increased in funding last year before this additional $180 million proposal?
Ms. Eng, do you have the final appropriation that we passed last year?
One moment, please.
Thank you.
While Ms. Eng is looking through, I think that information is publicly available. I don't recall the exact numbers. It's online and also can be viewed by the public.
Yes.
Ms. Eng?
Yeah. Total general fund spending in fiscal year 2023 was $123,108,000.
Lead Hamilton.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you so much. Members, I just wanted to remind you the amendments to the DE are due by 1 p.m. filing tomorrow, but we can talk more about it. But that's the deadline for the amendments to the DE. Any further questions from members before we proceed with testimony from the department? We'll start with Deputy Commissioner Majors. You can all come up. There are three seats there. So welcome to the committee, and I think this is your first presentation in front of the committee, so we will not ask you to bring treats to us.
I'll be next meeting.
No worries. So welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Noor, and
good afternoon.
Members of the community.
Deputy Commissioner McKinnon, welcome.
Thank you. I'll kick off this testimony here this afternoon. I'm Kevin McKinnon, Deputy Commissioner of Economic Development at DEED. And on behalf of DEED, I want to extend our thanks to you and to the members of your committee for your hard work in putting together this omnibus bill. With regard to the Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan's budget to move Minnesota forward, most central to this committee's focus is the economic plan to build Minnesota's economic success by investing in students, workers, communities and small businesses, all of which critical components that made our state's economy strong in the first place. Today I'll highlight some of the areas of DEED support and some of our concern. So thank you for making important investments in key areas that will support an equitable recovery, such as establishing and funding the Office of New Americans, additional supports for the Main Street Revitalization Program, a marketing campaign to market the state of Minnesota to businesses and potential workers, and increased funding to provide grants to organizations that provide small business assistance. It's clear you kept principles of equity at the center of your budget, and these are the kinds of investments that Minnesota should make now to grow our economy. There are some key programs in the governor's bill that were not included in the omnibus bill related to economic development that I would urge that you consider as we move forward, including Launch Minnesota, our state's small business startup program, and investments in electric vehicle infrastructure for our businesses to help accelerate our transition to a green economy. In the letter DEED submitted to the committee today, we also called out specific areas of concern that the committee should address to improve the bill. This includes extended timelines for the Main Street Economic Revitalization Grant Program, the Pandemic Relief Grant Program, and redevelopment grants. Language also tied to the SPARC small business loans and redevelopment grants, technical and staffing concerns tied to the Emerging Developer Loan Program, and administrative issues tied to the Canadian Border County's Economic Relief Program. Finally, I appreciate that the governor's recommended policy changes were included in the House Omnibus Bill, including access to the State Small Business Credit Initiative funds and our letter shares recommendations on how to make those funds more widely available. Now I'll turn it over to my colleague, Mark Majors.
Deputy Commissioner Mark Majors, welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thanks, Deputy Commissioner McKinnon. Good afternoon, everyone. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mark Majors, and I am the Deputy Commissioner for Workforce Development at DEED. I have a brief statement, and then we'll take questions. Workforce challenges are the most pressing concern we hear from businesses as they seek to find workers across employment sectors. It is good to see the committee has shared commitment to making investments in tech jobs pipelines for youth, even if that commitment is smaller than we had perceived it to be. However, I would like to emphasize our concerns that the House bill, Omnibus bill, does not entirely make other investments in growing our workforce recommended by the governor, including investments in adult technology reskilling training, funding for clean tech workforce training, and resources to modernize DEED's workforce tools. These priorities were carefully put forward after full review of gaps in the agency's toolkit to address modern workforce challenges. And we're concerned about our ability to deliver the excellent and pressing workforce development services our state needs without funding for these priorities. While you're we know there's different ways that you can actually fund programs. We do believe, though, a competitive grant process is the best way to move forward and more preferable to scale much more effectively to meet the moment in our economy. I appreciate that the governor's recommended policy and language changes were included in the House Omnibus Bill, including language around pay for performance, the definition of displaced homemaker, and the changes in definition for the uniform report card. DEED also noted some technical issues in the letter that was presented earlier, and I appreciate your attention to those details. Thank you for the opportunity to appear here today. Congratulations on putting together your Omnibus Bill. We know the committee has challenging work ahead. DEED is committed to working with you, and we thank you in advance for your consideration and feedback.
Thank you so much. Members, any questions? I see Representative Bates.
Mr. Chair, thank you. To Mr. McKenna, I wanted you to go back, if you could, about the, and I missed part of what you said about the Northland language that was in here. Your concerns were what again? I think it was the borderland support for businesses up there. What was your concern again?
Deputy Commissioner McKenna.
Mr. Chair and Representative Baker, our concerns with the Canadian Border Program were around administrative challenges. We are going to be working with a number of counties, I don't recall how many, and I believe it was 1% or so in the bill. Standard is 5%. We don't usually take 5% on the economic development side. We're closer to less than 3%. So that was one of our concerns that we raised.
Mr. Chair, just so it was about the administrative fees that you could sort of hold it to use with your support to that program. And I just maybe missed that part of it. So thank you. Appreciate that. Thanks.
Any further questions? Just wanted to appreciate the two deputy commissioners for your presentation. We've got a lot of work to do. I know this is something that we're aspiring to do compared to others who don't even want to invest in small businesses. We are committed to support small business. We're committed to supporting workers. We're committed to creating reskilling, upskilling, and next skilling. This bill reflects those priorities, and I look forward to working with both of you and the department. So. Thank you so much for your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that, we move to the other testifiers. Elena Gannam, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Chair Noor, members of the committee, my name is Elena Gorder. I'm the Chief Executive Officer with the Metropolitan Consortium of Community Developers. I'd like to thank you and the committee for your thoughtful consideration and inclusion of two funding areas we are advocating for this year on behalf of our members and Community Partners, which is House File 2978 and House File 3733. The Small Business Partnership Grant Program, formerly the Business Competitive Grant Program, has never seen a base increase since it was created in 2011. However, the $7 million one-time funding added last year to this underappreciated state program has already demonstrated the greater impact we can have across the state for businesses owned by Black, Indigenous, and people of color, women, people with disabilities, and veteran entrepreneurs. Because of the increase, 37 organizations, both in Greater Minnesota and the Twin Cities metro area, have been able to help hundreds of small businesses. This is up from the 14 that have been able to tap the funding in the past. During the past 2 years, Minnesota has relied on CDFIs and nonprofit economic development organizations to distribute hundreds of millions in financial assistance to small businesses while providing skilled advising services to work with these businesses to help them adapt and survive the economic impacts of the pandemic. DEE does not do this type of work and relies heavily upon this network of community-based organizations that work directly with small business owners across our entire state. These organizations are proud to do this work, and we're fortunate that this infrastructure was in place prior to the pandemic. But as our organizations are being asked to take on increasing responsibilities and fill roles where the state cannot, funding to support this work isn't growing. I know the state focuses a lot on how they can support big business that defines our economy, but the network of technical assistance providers focus on small businesses that define and support the communities that we call home. Think of the grocery stores, the childcare providers, pharmacies, coffee shops that we all use and visit every day. They often turn to us for guidance on how to adapt and even grow during the often rapidly shifting economic climate. The additional base funding for technical assistance through the Small Business Partnership Grant Program will be a game changer for small businesses for years to come. We're also thankful for the inclusion of funding to support shared ownership models in the committee's bill through the SPARK program. As you heard in committee on March 21st, many entrepreneurs and small business owners across the state face barriers to accessing financing for traditional businesses, which is why shared ownership models present a viable solution to some of our state's greatest economic needs. However, there's no funding that's currently targeted to this type of business. Some data. In Minnesota, we have 52,000 businesses that are owned by baby boomers, and 85% of these businesses do not have a succession plan. The loss of these businesses will shake our economy and impact close to $600,000 jobs. In Minnesota, transitioning even a portion of these businesses to an employee-owned model could secure our economic stability for our state. A powerful statistic. Nationally, 30% of all U.S. businesses were owned by its workers. Median Black household wealth would increase from $24,000 to $106,000. And average wealth of the bottom 20% of all households would quadruple. That's a game changer. These models have been shown to be particularly successful in BIPOC and low-wealth communities, as a recent survey by the Democracy at Work Institute showed that of newly formed worker cooperatives, the majority of worker owners were BIPOC. So in summary, the financial resources in House File 4355 have the potential to change the landscape of business in Minnesota. They will grow and retain business and jobs, increase private investment, and even most importantly, close the racial wealth gap. So before I close, I'd like to thank Chair Noor, Vice Chair Zhang for carrying these bills, and all of the members of the committee and staff for your hard work. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you so much for your testimony, particularly speaking on the SPARC Small Business Loan Program, which is a revolving loan for 5 years meant to support small businesses and also including the community shared ownership, which we are putting up to $600,000 that is available as a revolving loan. This is a significant investment to reignite development in many places. So the next person to testify is Peter McLaughlin. Welcome to the committee. Please join us and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's good to be back at the Capitol.
How many years ago?
Many years ago, 85 to 90. I was a member of the House, and it's always good to be in front of a House committee. So thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members. I'm Peter McLaughlin. I'm the executive director of the Local Initiative Support Corporation, Twin Cities, LISC. We are one of 39 local offices around the country, and including one in Duluth. So there are two LISC offices among the 39 offices of LISC. We're a nonprofit organization that provides capital for people, places, and projects that have difficulty accessing capital through the normal means. We are a recipient of the Main Street grant, along with our partners, led by the Minneapolis Foundation and Propel. Duluth is also a recipient of both a loan and a grant out of the Main Street Revitalization Program. We appreciate the attention that the Main Street Program has given in your bill, Mr. Chairman, and appreciate the changes that you have proposed. I'm here to advocate one additional change. It's a change in how the loan guarantee money that was appropriated last year by the legislature can be used. We have been in consultation with LISC Duluth and our national finance people, and we would like to offer a suggestion that would mobilize a substantial private capital. We think there's a better way to do that than the current language. We support that mobilization of private capital into these projects. And the suggestion that we have comes from our consultation with our New York LISC office, which helps to mobilize that capital. The current design does not provide significant credit enhancement, the loan guarantees in the program. By credit enhancement, I mean a ways in which the state funds could help elicit additional private capital or reduce the interest rate on the private investment that is made available. These are both critical to the success of this program. We're advocating the following changes in the loan guarantee provisions that exist in the law. We're asking that you create a second optional mechanism for using the loan guarantee funds. The existing mechanism would still be in place, but we're asking for a second mechanism. Make the second mechanism retroactive to cover the grants that were provided by the legislature last year. So we're not asking for new money, but we want to have a different way of deploying the existing loan guarantee funds. Three, we would ask that you permit the loan guarantee funds to constitute 20% of any Main Street revitalization loan package. So they'd be a part of the loan package. And four, that you make the state loan guarantee fund subordinate to the other loan capital in any given loan package. So this would provide what we call first loss protection. And by that, we mean that in the event of a default, repayment would first be applied to the private capital and then to the state loan capital, so that it's a buffer again for the loss by other investors, and by being a buffer, it then brings out additional private capital that can be deployed for these projects, and it brings it out at a lower rate of interest than was otherwise provided. We've successfully used this model using Hennepin County funds as the first loss funds in financing six property acquisitions by community partners in some of the areas in Minneapolis that are in recovery. There's a seventh financing that's already been approved by our LISC credit committee. It's helped us to procure two major project-related investments, PRIs, from the Bush Foundation, the McKnight Foundation, a significant grant and credit enhancement from JP Morgan Chase, and a preliminary commitment for an additional PRI investment from another major Minnesota corporation. In addition to that, LISC itself has provided half of the financing in these projects as well, and we continue to do that. And there are multiple projects still in the pipeline. So, Mr. Chairman, those loans have gone out the six that I've described to you and the seven that's in the works, those have gone out at a 2.6 to 2.75% rate of interest. So they're very favorable rate of interest, and that's what we're trying to do, is to use the state funds in a way that would provide additional private investment by allowing the use of the existing state loan guarantee funds to be activated as a part of a loan in a loan package, and that in that way we think we could continue to make these investments and bring private capital in. We applaud the legislature's intent last year in trying to bring forward private capital. What we would like to do, though, is to create a better mechanism for the use of the money that you set aside last year. So, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to stand for questions.
Members, any questions? Mr. McClellan, I believe you're working with the department. They've seen the language that you're proposing.
We are going to be sending, we're sending it over, just being drafted right now. We're working with the House Counsel, and we'll be, our intention is to work with the department as soon as we get that language drafted.
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. McLaughlin, if you could share with us, again, List has a history here in the state and certainly in the probably the metro more, and again now developing in Duluth. Can you just give us an idea about, you know, when we're in this line of business, and I've been on EDA boards, and we have always have some default, you know, loans, and can you give us just an idea over the last few years, what's an average, you know, what are your defaults that we're looking at if you're asking for the state to kind of be that you know, last paid back kind of an amount? Sure. What should we expect from a, you know, loans don't always get paid back. So what do you see happening in these kind of things with your defaults?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative. Number one, we expect the loans to be paid back.
Right.
Number two, I'd say Duluth, I can't quote the number. I think the LISC office there has been in existence for 25 years, so it's got a track record. We've been in existence for over 30 years in the Twin Cities, and LISC nationally has been in existence over 40 years. Our default rate is less than 1% on the loans. So we expect to be paid back. We do, you know, very, very in-depth credit analysis. And the only way we can continue to get private investors to come into our deals is if they get their money back. And so we understand that requirement, and we would apply that in this case as well.
Thank you. Thank you.
So I also understand that there's that collateral, you know, the five C's as we keep on talking about, that whenever you're investing, there's that collateral that you already have. If in the event of a loss, you can collect based on that.
The individual borrower has to brings equity to these deals as well. Yes, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Thank you so much. Any further questions? I don't see that. So thank you so much for that. We'll look forward to adding the amendments as we get it. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
The next person is Ms. Perez, Gloria Perez. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Knorr and Lead Hamilton. My name is Gloria Perez, and I am President and CEO of the Women's Foundation of Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 4355, which will provide funds for the Women's Foundation to invest in the tools needed to build, retain, and strengthen generational wealth for Black women. Thank you, Chair Knorr, for including this provision in your omnibus bill, and thank you, Representative Moran, for raising this important issue in your proposal. For 39 years, the Women's Foundation has made community investments across the state and advanced policy to create a state where women, girls, and their families thrive. Our commitment to systems-level change that centers community extends from our historic investments in Minnesota Girls Are Not For Sale to the Young Women's Initiative of Minnesota, and continues today with investments in research and policy change. With the Center on Women, Gender, and Public Policy at the Humphrey School, we produce the state's leading research on the well-being of women and girls every 2 years. And last month, we released our 2022 Status of Women and Girls research to provide important data about what is happening in our state. Members, you received a copy of the report, and I hope you'll find it useful as you make data-driven policy. The data from our report and the community voices we center demonstrate that the essential building blocks of economic security and wealth building consistently shortchange our Black, Indigenous, Latina, immigrant, women of color, and other women of color. The wage gap continues to shortchange all women, and most significantly, women at the intersections of gender, race, and ethnicity, women who are Latina, Black, or Indigenous. On average, Minnesota women make 81 cents for every dollar that men make. The gender wage gap experienced over a lifetime is one of the most important drivers of the wealth gap between men and women. Another key driver of the wealth gap is the gap in home ownership. Discriminatory housing practices like redlining and racial covenants have limited the ability of Black families to acquire the most important building blocks to wealth, a home. Again, when we intersect race, ethnicity with gender, we see that women who are Black, Latina, or Indigenous face the most significant barriers. There's also a significant gap between men and women when it comes to business ownership, another important pathway to economic security and wealth building. Of the over 375 firms in Minnesota, only 32% are owned by women, and of those, only 5% by women of color. If we are to address the significant gaps in wages, home and business ownership and wealth, we must take direct action. The Women's Foundation of Minnesota has experience with investments to tackle these issues with this grant. Since 2018, the Women's Foundation has invested directly in young women entrepreneurs with our Innovator Program. When I had the opportunity to testify 2 weeks ago, I shared the story of Hilal Ibrahim, who has used her Innovator Grant from 2018 to source materials and create handmade hijabs and henna by and for Muslim women. Her business and company have grown, and now her high-quality, fashionable hijabs and headscarves are sold in Nordstrom stores. And this is just one success story of what happens when we invest in women and their capacity to build their own financial futures. The bill before the committee will provide important investments in Black women's financial capacity and empowerment. Investing in women benefits children, families, and communities. Building wealth is key to financial security for generations to come and a more prosperous Minnesota for everyone. So thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you so much, Ms. Perez, for your testimony. The next person is Kenya McKnight Ahad. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Hello. Can you hear me okay? Sorry about that.
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay. Thank you. Kenya McKnight Ahad, President and CEO of the Black Women's Wealth Alliance. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee, for hearing me. It's so wonderful to hear about all the different initiatives that came before me, and I'm in 100% support of all of them. I think this is an opportune time to make these extraordinary investments in our community across the state. My work is focused on uplifting Black women, African-American women, in the space of wealth, and we do it through a cultural lens. We've been around since 2014, started as a work group of 20 Black women meeting at McDonald's on West Broadway in North Minneapolis, and we've expanded out over the last 8 years to serving up to 4,000 Black women across the state who are business owners as well as workers and students, helping them understand cultural wealth education, providing them with business cultural technical support, and also directly investing grants and some equity capital into their businesses, but also helping them purchase homes, paying for closing cost assistance, or down payment assistance, closing cost, assisting with credit, assisting with whatever they've identified as barriers to them building wealth. We operate in the space of intermediary, where we get our people ready to succeed and to participate in the broader programs, and we have to do that through our cultural lens and moving beyond just education, but helping them with direct implementation of building their knowledge, their skills, their networks, and understanding of the broader entrepreneurial and workforce systems. And we do that seamlessly through navigational support. Our work is critically important, and what we're asking for is an expansion or just resources to help our existing fund called the Asset Wealth Fund. Again, today that fund has contributed over $2.5 million to Black businesses across the Twin Cities and Greater Minnesota and the you know, suburban areas. Businesses, students, as well as, you know, workers who are looking to grow their careers, but they need training, they need help paying for different classes and things to grow, you know, opportunities for themselves. I'll just talk about one quick example here in how we fill gaps, which our work is critical because we can fill those gaps. We worked with one of the largest Black construction companies in Minnesota now, Tri Construction, who was not lendable by most of the, you know, existing banks or nonprofits based on a few other challenges they had. So our work, we were able to step in and offer them up to $25,000 in quick equity capital to assist them with being able to complete projects. As you may know, you know, they've worked on the Twin Stadiums, the U.S., the soccer stadium, and a lot of different projects. And they're, you know, a growing company. They needed quick capital without process too much. And so we were able to step in and help them. And then in that, we were able to facilitate over $750,000 worth of lending by pulling together over four CDFI nonprofit lenders. And we worked with them seamlessly for 8 months to build their vision. For how they want to grow their company over time and to, you know, work with the lenders on how to invest the $750,000 and to help them with a repayment strategy, which they are doing very well today. And so that's just an example of some of my work. Some of you may have heard the testimony of Tamika Jones from Lipstein in the last committee meeting, another business, and know that we were able to step in and help out with her growth and expansion. And now she's having a grand opening, which I hope you attend on the 15th of April. So our work is essential, and supporting our fund helps us continue to fill the gaps for our community, which is critical. We are the only Black woman-owned, led, and focused institution on wealth building and economics. And again, it's more than education for us. It's about walking our people through the process, but also directly stepping in to invest in their ability to succeed. Thank you so much for listening, and here for any questions you may have.
Thank you so much. The next person on the list is Tao Mi Zhong. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Noor. My name is Tao Mei Shong, and I'm the Executive and Network Director of the Coalition of Asian American Leaders, also known as CAL. We are a cross-sector, cross-ethnic, and cross-generational network of over 5,500 Asian Minnesotan leaders throughout the state of Minnesota, reaching as far north as Thief River Falls and as far south as Worthington, with a significant number of folks in Minneapolis, St. Paul Park, and Cottage Grove. I'm here today to express my strong support for House File 4355 and to thank the chair and members of the committee for including funding for Asian Minnesotans to address the economic challenges facing our frontline workers, small businesses, and nonprofits. As you've heard me testify before, Asian Minnesotans have been hit hard by the impact of COVID-19 and the disturbing rise of violence directed at Asian Minnesotans. CAL released a report last year which illustrated the severity of the COVID impact on Asian Minnesotans. Asian Minnesotans make up only 5% of our state's population, but we made up 8% of the COVID ICU cases and 6% of COVID deaths in 2020. The significant number of deaths in our community have serious economic consequences for Asian Minnesotan families, nonprofits, and small businesses. As you've heard from many testifiers today, small businesses are often the lifeblood of many communities. This is the same for Asian Minnesotans. And our Asian Minnesotan small businesses continue to struggle, while some have been able to rebound from COVID-19. During the pandemic, CAL conducted a survey of Asian-owned small businesses and asked them about their experiences. And we learned a few key things, but I'm only going to cite a few facts. One is that 43% of small Asian-owned businesses were unable to pay their bills. 50% of small Asian-owned businesses had to reduce their business hours or temporarily close. And then 72% of Asian small businesses had either decreased or had no revenue at all. And then on top of this, many small businesses expressed that they had to restructure how they do business as a result of the increased incidences and threats of anti-Asian hate to their business as well as their employees. The small business owners we surveyed were very clear about the kind of help that they wanted and needed. They told us that direct legislative support is critical, as well as providing technical assistance, language access, and training to ensure that they could access government programs and grants to help them keep their businesses open. The funding in House File 4355 will allow us, Cal, to leverage our organizational strengths to build economic resiliency within Asian Minnesotan communities. Cal can leverage our grant management expertise, original research and data, and extensive network of leaders to support our small businesses and nonprofits. We have a strong track record of providing grants into our communities and are ready to put these skills and infrastructure to use. And I just want to close by saying thank you again to you, Mr. Chair, and the members of the committee for recognizing the urgent economic challenges facing our Asian Minnesotan communities. Thank you.
Thank you, Tommy Xiong. The next person is Shep Harris. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Shep Harris with Fredrickson and Byron. And if you don't mind, Mr. Chair, I can stay within my few minutes of time, but I'm actually wearing three hats today, and so I'll be very brief.
Should we start with the mayor?
not that hat. But thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, again, Shep Harris with Fredrickson and Byron. I'm here, as I mentioned, I'm wearing three hats. The first one is with the Center for Economic Inclusion, and they would like to thank you for including partial funding from Representative Richardson's House File 3250 in the omnibus bill. That's the Inclusive Job Growth Fund. And House File 3250 asks for $10 million, my apologies, $10 million. The chair's amendment includes $2 million in funding. The center does thank you and believes that this the pay-for-performance contracts and business development services, which would be a part of the Inclusive Job Growth Fund, are scalable. So we think it's doable, and we say thank you. The center would also just like to briefly thank the committee members, Representative Greenman, Representative Dabney, Representative Xiong, and Representative Olson for your support by co-authoring this bill. Mr. Chair, the next item, in serving thousands of Minnesotans with disabilities who desire ongoing access to various job sectors, the Minnesota Organization for Habilitation and Rehabilitation, known as MORE, would like to encourage inclusion of House File 4075 in the Omnibus Finance Bill. This bill has been chief authored by Representative Xiong and co-authored by Representative Hamilton. It proposes a $2.285 million ongoing annual increase to what's known as the extended employment provider rate. This was done 7 years ago by this committee, and so we're back, unfortunately, because of the marketplace. The rate increase can help providers stay competitive in the marketplace with adequately hourly wages for staff who provide these invaluable workplace supports to people with disabilities. And finally, Mr. Chair, on behalf of thousands of Somali young adults across the state who participate in activities with Kajog, I'd like to encourage inclusion of Representative Hassan's House File 4117 in the proposed omnibus bill. As you might recall from a hearing that was held in this committee, this bill proposes $2 million in one-time funding for a statewide phlebotomy training and certification program through Kajog and the Pathway Career Training Center. This would address a staffing shortage around the state in this particular medical field. So, and of course, Kajog would like to thank Representative Gomez and Representative Xiong for co-authoring this bill as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for your time and consideration.
Thank you so much, Chip Harris, for that. The next person to testify is Baba Letang. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Earl of Baba Letang. I go by Baba, B-A-B-A-L-E-T-A-N-G, last name. Thank you again, Mr. Chair and committee members. I thank you for the opportunity. I represent Neighborhood Development Center, NDC. And I just want to testify in our support of House Omnibus Bill HF 4355. I have been with NDC for 16 years, and I have firsthand opportunity to see the effectiveness of the program that NDC works, support to small businesses at the mid and lower market. And NDC has a track record. So everything that we're doing right now is not just talking about something we wish to do or hope to do. It's something that we've already done, and we've been asking for support, not just for NDC, but for the community to continue to help small businesses. So today I really want to express our gratitude for the support, and especially in this bill, for all what, you know, the provision made to support the small businesses. NDC's goal is to empower entrepreneurs with business knowledge and access to opportunity to develop successful businesses that bring them into the mainstream economy and jobs and revitalize their communities. So NDC is committed to going into communities and building communities from within. A lot of the businesses we work with, they have fewer than 10 employees, and many of them, they work along Twin City commercial corridors, and we also work with partners assisting small and micro businesses in Greater Minnesota. So not just here, but we are also working in partnership with other partners in Greater Minnesota. 88% of NDC assisted entrepreneurs are people of color. So we are very true to the mission of driving our whole economy up. And we want to thank you again for the support. Specifically going to the bill, NDC, we requested lended funding for lending, including real estate loans to help BIPOC entrepreneurs to purchase their own buildings. Because, you know, we're talking about wealth building, and that's a very, very practical way that we can change that, you know, that pattern where people can actually, you know, from generation to generation, we see an increase in wealth building here. NDC or incubators, we also provide permanent affordable space on major commercial corridors, and we also support development of similar incubators in Greater Minnesota. So what we have several incubators where we provide jobs and opportunities and to help our small businesses. So we're very happy to see that. In the bill, we are also glad to see the priorities given to small business, for example, the Pandemic Relief Grant Program, which sets aside for businesses with fewer than 6 employees, as well as for BIPOC-owned businesses. We saw that in the bill, and we're very happy to see that. Technical assistance is also a major thing that NDC does. We have four pillars. We have our training class, we have our technical assistance, we have our incubators, and we also have our lending program. And technical assistance is very important, not just to our small businesses, but NDC, because of the partnership we've developed over all these years since we've been in existence, we work with partners. So we are here not just supporting our own organization, but also helping other organizations to continue to do the work and provide even more strategic technical assistance. So NDC is very grateful that provision makes additional funding here for technical assistance. Obviously, we did not see NDC in a direct appropriation this year, but we are very grateful that many of our businesses, small businesses, are getting the help that they need. And I really want to emphasize that this year especially is a very, very important year as to the decision that we make in terms of trust. Now that we expect a lot of money in the surplus, I think that's a great opportunity to build in trust for small businesses. So in rounding up here, we also see, you know, equitable access to capital, and we've heard our earlier testifiers talk about that. NDC try to maintain, you know, integrity in our community. And we also want to make sure that the people that we work with, they are non-bankable. There's people that will go to a bank and they will not get loan. But we know that they have a dream. We know that they want to make Minnesota better. So what we do as an organization is to provide that funding to help them. And in this bill, I see a lot of provision for that. So today we just want to express our thanks, and we will continue to work more on the details. But today we just want to testify on in our support of this bill and to thank you very much for all the help that you've given to NDC and all of our other organizations and the entrepreneurs that we work with. So, Mr. Chair, I just want to stop here and say thank you for everything.
Thank you so much for your testimony. The next person on the list is Lane Shelton. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lynn Shelton, and I serve as the Vice President of Marketing and Organizational Development for Enterprise Minnesota. And Enterprise Minnesota is a nonprofit consulting organization that works with Minnesota's small manufacturers throughout the state to help them compete and grow profitably. And we want them to be the employer of choice in their communities by providing excellent careers for all their residents. We're here today to thank each of you for including the Growth Acceleration Program, or what we call GAP, in the House omnibus bill in the amount of $800,000 for the remainder of the fiscal, or excuse me, the biennium. Since 2008, this program has on average proven its return on the state's investment by at least $15 for every dollar invested. Some manufacturers have testified that these funds conservatively have yielded 30-to-1 per investment. GAP helps small manufacturing companies in Minnesota get the help they need to stay in business, keep their employees, and grow. It has helped hundreds of Minnesota small manufacturing companies across the state with business improvement services that they might not otherwise afford without this hand up. All companies awarded GAP resources must match every dollar from the state with a dollar of their own. The state has invested in GAP for 11 years. It has achieved widespread bipartisan support because it helps manufacturers create and retain high-quality jobs and brings economic stability to local communities. Manufacturing is a key economic driver in our state's economy, and particularly in Greater Minnesota, where manufacturing jobs are most often the lifeblood of local communities. To qualify for GAP, manufacturers or manufacturing-related companies must be located in Minnesota, must operate as independent profit centers, and employ 250 or fewer full-time employees. They must work from a solid business plan, demonstrate a tangible economic need. The program is administered by Enterprise Minnesota, and DEED acts as the fiscal agent. In addition to GAP benefiting companies, its benefits ripple throughout Minnesota's economy. 1 in 7 jobs in Minnesota are manufacturing related, and every job created by manufacturers generates almost 2 additional jobs. That's over 33% of all state jobs. The results are impressive. An independent survey of manufacturers who have received GAP shows that they have collectively created and or retained 12,556 jobs. They have boosted and retained company sales by $1.4 billion and saved $206 million in business costs. And these companies have invested $583 million in their plant equipment, technology, and employee skills development. Looking back over the last 2 years, the COVID economy did not hit all manufacturers with equal measures of pain as did the Great Recession of 2008 and 2009. It's true that some of our manufacturers are still trying to survive against difficult fluctuations in demand. Others are struggling to keep up with rapidly growing demand within targeted sectors. Our point is that these diverse circumstances highlight how your inclusion of the GAP program in the jobs bill will provide small manufacturing companies with enhanced productivity, internal efficiencies that will help them cope, and continue to provide communities well-paying jobs with benefits. And as I mentioned when I testified on March the 9th, all of you have manufacturing companies in your districts, and all of you have constituents who work for those companies. Once the session is complete and you have a bit more time to breathe, Enterprise Minnesota would be delighted to arrange a tour for you for your manufacturing constituents. It's a lot of fun to see the amazing products made right here in Minnesota. So on behalf of the small and underserved manufacturers throughout the state, I hope the full legislature will help them grow and remain employers of excellent careers through this $800,000 authorization. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much for your testimony. If there's no any question, the next person on the list is Sam Wijing. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Well, Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Sam Ritchie. I'm here on behalf of the Economic Development Association of Minnesota, a statewide association of over 400 public and private sector members. Can be pretty brief, Mr. Chair. We're here to say a hearty thank you for including supplemental funding for the Redevelopment Grant Program. I think as members are well aware, that program has not been funded with its own base funding for several cycles in a row, and instead has relied on transfer authority from deed from the Minnesota Investment Fund, which we are appreciative of, both the authority and deed's repeated use of it, but for planning purposes and the certainty that comes with that base funding, we do prefer to have its own line item on the budget. So I want to thank you, Mr. Chair, for including it in your bill, and I'd like to also thank Representative Cagle for authoring the bill in the first place. So thank you very much. The only things I wanted to highlight really are in your packet, there is a handout from Deed that shows sort of the eye-popping return on investment that this program has garnered since with all the state investment it has received. And I also believe that our friends from Metro City have a letter in your packet also supporting this program. So the only other note I wanted to make to the committee was that I believe the latest round of redevelopment award letters were sent out on Friday. And my understanding is that that program was completely drained again, and there's still about $1.75 million in requests that were not able to be funded out of that. So always oversubscribed, so thank you very much for your inclusion of funding for 2023, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Ritchie. So as I understand, the program usually it goes through the local government to initiate that process.
Correct, Mr. Chair.
All right, so thank you so much for your testimony.
Thank you.
The next person on the list is Scott McMahon. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Scott McMahon. I'm the Executive Director of the Greater Minnesota Partnership. We're a coalition of businesses and local governments throughout Greater Minnesota working on addressing the jobs and economic expansion challenges and opportunities throughout our communities. I'm here. There are a number of issues I can speak on, but today I want to speak specifically about the inclusion of the $4 million for the Deed Child Care Grant Program and the policy language regarding the initiative foundations and the child care money that they have received. Let me begin by thanking Representative Olson for carrying this legislation. These dollars have been critically important throughout Greater Minnesota and in the Metro in helping us address the child care shortage. As we face historically low unemployment rates throughout Greater Minnesota, when a business is looking to recruit new employees and they need to relocate in that community, if we don't have child care, then we don't have those jobs happening. And so, If we want to see economic growth in our communities, we need to do more to address the 40,000 childcare slot shortage that we have. And these dollars, as we've shown over the past 5 years that this program has been in existence, has done a remarkable job in supporting business expansion in the childcare industry throughout our community. So thank you for investing more resources in this program. I also want to commend you for including the policy language for the initiative foundations. We realized when they got their funding last year that they didn't have the authority to subgrant those dollars to partner organizations, and so they had to go through machinations to try and figure out how to contract with those organizations, which presents some challenges for this one. So this policy language will streamline their ability to provide their resources and services in our six regions. So thank you for including that language.
Well, thank you so much, Mr. McMahon. We all know many women, especially mothers who haven't gone back to the workforce because of the pandemic, and they're struggling, and hence our commitment to make sure that we invest in childcare in this committee. Thanks to Vice Chair Olson for her commitment to do so. So thank you so much. The next person on the list is Ms. Bendix, Carrie Bendix. Welcome to the committee and introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Carrie Bendix. I'm the Executive Director of the Southwest Minnesota Private Industry Council and our Regional Workforce Development Board. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I'm speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Workforce Boards in support of the House omnibus bill that provides $20 million in funding to the local workforce development boards to address the critical workforce needs in all 87 counties of Minnesota. Employer-led workforce boards are responsible for the strategic investment of the employment and training funding in their communities. Disinvestment in workforce funding at a federal level over the last several years has greatly impacted our ability to fully realize the strategies needed to address today's current challenges, including racial inequities and an unprecedented statewide workforce shortage. Local boards are hearing from employers daily that are in desperate need for workers, and they need help recruiting, training, and retaining their workforce, their talent. This is especially true for small businesses, many of whom were most impacted by the pandemic. The labor shortage is overwhelmingly the top challenge businesses are facing, and it is impacting their ability to maintain and grow their companies. On the job seeker side, Minnesota has unlimited opportunities in high demand and well-paying jobs, such as technology, healthcare, and manufacturing. It's our role to make sure everyone in the state has the same opportunity to enter these fields with the skills and training they need to make themselves competitive. As Minnesota's workforce system, local workforce boards want the ability to meet this moment. As you're all aware, the state's workforce shortage and racial disparities worsened during the pandemic. Local boards and their partners are working hard to address these critical issues, but can't do much more without more funding. Things we would do and we would focus on is conducting targeted outreach and marketing, focusing on underserved populations with supportive services and case management, working with our local partners in education, workforce, and economic development to innovate and to really address the local needs, and provide intensive services to employers to address the hiring and retention needs. When you invest in the local board, you're not investing in a program, but in the entire workforce system that serves every corner of the state, including each of your districts. Help us meet this moment. And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I also would like to just note that we'd prefer the funds come from the general fund, as appropriations taken out of the Workforce Development Fund will impact the allocation for the state dislocated worker program. And we didn't want to lose capacity for current programming, given the large need. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Any questions or discussion? See none. Ms. Gropman, Jane, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Chair Noor and members of the committee, I'm Jane Gropman, the Executive Director of the International Institute of Minnesota. Thank you for including House File 3807 in the omnibus bill to support agencies working with new Americans. We are grateful for your hard work on this committee and the inclusion of support for new Americans in our state. New American workers are a critical part of the future of our workforce. They are younger workers compared to native-born workers, and the majority of new workers in our labor force. As I stated last time, over 97% of the new workers in our state in 2017 were new Americans. Pretty remarkable statistic. They also spend $12.4 billion annually in our state, so quite a bit of spending power, and pay $4.5 billion in taxes. So this investment in this bill will help support immigrants at all educational and workforce levels, work levels, so that they can move up the economic ladder more quickly, integrate more quickly in order to thrive in our state. So thank you, Chair Noor and members of the committee. Happy to stand for any questions.
Any discussions? Seeing none, thank you so much for your testimony. The next person is Shelley Hansen. Welcome to the committee, please. Introduce yourself for the record, then proceed.
Good afternoon. I'm Shelley Hansen. I'm the president of the Hibbing Area Chamber of Commerce in Hibbing in Greater Minnesota. I appreciate the opportunity to speak on behalf of the businesses in my community. Last week, I spoke on House File 4522, which is in regards to grant funding to specific businesses that were affected by COVID. And we know that many of our businesses received different types of grants and loans throughout the COVID period of time. And now we're looking at new challenges within our communities. And we heard quite a bit of talk about labor, payrolls, supply issues throughout even today's hearing. And I can give you a few specific examples right in my own community of the things that are happening here. In the area of payroll and labor shortage, I'm finding that I have one business that's paying $3,000 more a month in salaries for employees with less employees. And then on top of it, he still has to close one day a week because he doesn't have enough labor. I have another employee who's paying double minimum wage in order to get employees. And this would have been somebody that normally in these positions would have paid around minimum wage or a little bit more for experience, longevity, good performance. And now she's not even able to do that because she's already paying double the minimum wage that she would have normally paid before. In the area of supplies, I can talk about one young woman who has a supply chain issue, so she can't get her materials when needed. She went out and took a personal loan so that she could have the capital money available so that she could take advantage of getting the supplies when it was ready and available and have it for her business. I have another business in my community as well who the supplies that she needed for her customers were right around $7. She's now paying $20. And so these costs have increased from payroll to labor shortage to supply chain issues. These are new things that our businesses are experiencing in 2022 and moving forward. So any help that we can help with our businesses in these areas is a good thing. We do know that our businesses are our communities, and our communities are affected by our businesses, and our businesses give back to our communities. So whenever we can support our businesses, we're supporting the residents and our communities as well. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Any discussion? See none. We'll now move to Mr. Wogsland. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Lead Hamilton, members and staff. My name is Ben Wogsland. I'm the Executive Vice President for Hospitality Minnesota. We represent Minnesota's resort and campground, lodging, and food service industries here. This industry employs 1 in 10 Minnesotans. It is a huge economic driver for our state, generating $16 billion annually in economic activity and generates 20% of the sales tax. So it's a fundamental part of both our way of life here in Minnesota, but also our economy. I want to speak to three things here today, Mr. Chair. Number one, Hospitality Minnesota is in support of the grant relief to border businesses and those that were impacted by the closure of the border and the BWCA. We think that's pretty straightforward, and we appreciate the inclusion of Representative Eklund's bill here in the omnibus bill. Number two, we support the concept of the pandemic relief to small businesses here in Minnesota as well, the framework brought forward by Representative Sandstead. We'd strongly encourage the committee and the legislature more broadly to look at a much larger target for the grant relief program, however. As I testified last week, this industry has been the hardest hit economically in the state. We know from most recent survey data that we're not out of the woods in this recovery. Two-thirds of restaurants saw lower than normal revenue in the winter quarter, and a half of them expect lower than normal revenue here in the quarter coming up. Same with hotels. Half saw lower revenue, and half expect lower revenue. And over half of both restaurants and hotels do not expect to return to normal revenue until 2023. At the same time, they're experiencing higher costs. Inflation is hitting them significantly, supply chain issues, and other costs, as well as trying to pay down debt. We know that two-thirds of restaurants took on significant debt due to COVID over the last 2 years. We know that over half of hotels did the same. So we're in a situation where the legislature has a unique opportunity, in our view, to help speed and hasten the depth and the pace of this recovery for this really critical industry. For context, I would point out that in the state of Wisconsin, to our east, they've done about $900 million in direct grant relief to small businesses impacted by COVID. So we think that a larger investment, both increasing the total target but also increasing the amount of grants, is something that should be in strong consideration as we go forward, especially considering the $9 billion surplus that we have right now. We would also encourage this committee and the legislature to take a hard look at doing a relief program specifically that includes hotels and overnight accommodation. The state still has not stood up a program to directly help those businesses that were hard impacted by COVID. And we know from recent reporting that the Twin Cities area had one of the lowest occupancy rates, if not the lowest in the country over the last year. At least two dozen suburban and exurban hotels are currently on a watch list for potential failure here. And there are challenges geographically around the state because so many of them took on debt and due to the COVID conditions. Again, we would point out to our neighbors to the east, they had stood up about a $93 million grant program in that state, and it was based on a per key or per room analysis to try to right size that program there and make sure they got relief to the places that it would be most helpful. So happy to work with the committee, you, Mr. Chair, and any other people that would be willing to look at both targets and the scope of that as well. Lastly, I would like to implore the committee to reconsider House File 3550, chief authored by Representative Baker. This is a bipartisan legislature that passed out of this committee on a unanimous basis, also passed the Higher Ed Committee on a unanimous basis, and would create a online hospitality training program that would be managed by the U of M Tourism Center. You'll remember hearing from Director Xinyi Chen over there, as well as an operator in the industry that's worked both in here in Minnesota as a manager and in South Dakota, which the program is based on. Again, it's only $275,000 of seed money to create this online hospitality training program that we think could train up to 4,000 or more workers per year. We know that this industry is still down 32,000 workers from pre-pandemic levels. If you look at the total jobs deficit right now in private employers, it's about 100,000. So that's literally a third of the folks that are no longer in the workforce are probably represented by hospitality businesses. So many of the employees that have been brought back in over the last 6 to 9 months have been brand new workers to the industry and brand new workers in general. So they need training tools. They need these tools to be able to become efficient quicker, to be able to ladder up quicker in their career within the industry. And we really think this is a positive program. They've had wonderful success with it in South Dakota. And for such a small, in our view, investment, we think it could generate so much more economic revenue for the state through putting people to work and helping them get up and going. So I know the committee and the legislature has a lot of challenges. You guys have a tough job balancing all the needs of Minnesotans. But given how important this industry is, we appreciate your consideration on all three of those items. And I'd be happy to stand for any questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions from members? I see none. Thank you so much for your testimony, Mr. Wolfsland. So we'll be in touch as we proceed with our process. So.
All right, thank you.
The next person on the list is Marie Elms. Welcome to the committee, and I see Ms. Mortensen too. So please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, and good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Marie Ellis. I'm the Public Policy Director at the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. We were very excited when we saw the first version of the omnibus bill that included a $50 million nonprofit relief fund. Unfortunately, that was removed in the DE amendment. And so we're here to talk about why we'd like to see that put back in. So I'd like to take a few minutes to talk about what the last 2 years have looked like for the nonprofit sector. Many of you are familiar with the nonprofit sector through your personal life and through hearing from nonprofits and committees. But you probably haven't stopped to consider the breadth of the whole nonprofit sector. Nonprofits that provide human services are often the first that people think of, and they're certainly a large segment of our sector. But we also use a much broader definition than the legislature when we talk about human services. We'd include in that category education and job training, services for veterans, services for seniors, and then what you normally might think of, hunger relief, emergency shelter, and things like that. I could go on, but I know committee's almost over. We've also got a lot of nonprofits that are not in the human services sector, things like historical societies, humane societies, faith-based nonprofits, nature centers, and environmental protection organizations. Since the beginning of COVID, my organization, the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits, has done 5 COVID impact surveys of our members. The most recent one was done in December 2021, so just about 4 months ago. And in each of those five surveys, the percentage of nonprofits who report seeing increased demand continues to increase. So I think we might assume that there was a spike in demand for nonprofit services at the beginning of the pandemic and that that's been slowly recovering, and it's simply not the case. There was a spike and it just keeps going up. So nonprofits are continuing to see a lot more demand. For almost 2 years now, we've been dealing with increased cost, as I said, increased demand, ethically uncertain funding, workforce shortages, and volunteer shortages. In that same survey, we saw that about half of nonprofits can only operate for 12 months or less before they become, before they exhibit financial distress, and most of those were 6 months or less. Members, our sector is running on fumes. We've been talking with nonprofits about what they need, and we carefully created a proposal for a nonprofit relief fund that would provide general operating grants to nonprofits that have experienced financial stress due to COVID-19. We're asking for $200 million, which would be split 50-50 between the 7-county metro area and Greater Minnesota, and that nonprofit relief fund would prioritize nonprofits hit hardest by COVID. Small nonprofits, especially in Greater Minnesota, nonprofits that provide human services, again with that very broad definition, and culturally specific nonprofits, those that support historically underserved cultural communities. I can't stress enough the vital work that nonprofits have been doing with, again, increased demand, increased costs, uncertain funding, workforce shortages, and volunteer shortages. Our state needs nonprofits to continue their critical work, and they need your support right now. Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to share the importance of a nonprofit relief fund with you.
Thank you so much for your testimony, Mrs. Mortensen. Well, Ms. Mortensen, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Noor and members of the committee. My name is Katina Mortensen. I'm the Public Policy Director at the Minnesota Council on Foundations, and we represent Minnesota Philanthropy and have more than 150 foundations across the state in our membership. I'm here today to build on Marie Ellis's testimony and to share our disappointment that the $50 million in funding for nonprofit relief was removed from this bill with the Delete All Amendment. I had previously planned to testify to thank the committee for the support, but I now come before you to help the committee understand why we were advocating for nonprofit relief in the first place, and that nonprofits have been largely overlooked in federal and state COVID relief packages. That pattern is unfortunately unbroken given the changes made to this bill. Despite the pandemic-related challenges and impacts nonprofits have faced, federal and state relief programs have largely excluded nonprofits and have not been designed with them in mind. You might be wondering, hasn't there been federal relief for nonprofits and didn't we pass them at the state level? There is a one-pager that we included that kind of goes over it in detail, but I'll briefly summarize. At the federal level, PPP loans were very important for nonprofits. The problem was that fewer than half of the eligible nonprofits in Minnesota received them. It's largely because the program was administered by the Small Business Administration and really designed for small businesses, so it wasn't a great fit for nonprofits, especially smaller nonprofits. At the state level, there have been a number of small business relief grants, and some of them have allowed nonprofits to be eligible, like the Small Business Relief Program through the counties and the Main Street COVID grant program. The challenge was that nonprofits, a very small slice of nonprofits were eligible, just those that earn revenue like businesses. So theaters or YMCAs, but many of the nonprofits, the types that Marie talked about, are not included in that definition. And I see that that same narrow definition is included in today's small business relief programs that were in the bill. In addition to the small business relief programs that had a limited amount of nonprofit eligibility, there are obviously state contracts with some nonprofit organizations on an individual basis for their work. It's important to keep in mind those dollars are restricted and function more like a contract for services. So that is categorically different than a relief program, where dollars are meant to reach a large number of organizations and to provide support for their recovery, for their health and stability. Similar to the small business programs that have been offered. So we're really, really looking for that for the nonprofit sector. Our state's approach to date has excluded the vast majority of nonprofits from accessing relief dollars, and the Nonprofit Relief Fund would remedy this lack of relief by supporting nonprofits that provided critical services to community members during the pandemic, like homeless shelters, food shelves, mental health supports, culturally specific offerings, and more. These nonprofits do not earn revenue like businesses, and they faced exploding demand, a decimated volunteer force, and had to make quick and often very costly operational and safety changes during the pandemic. With nonprofits employing 14% of Minnesota's workforce, we know that a designated relief program actually designed for nonprofits and the unique COVID-related impacts they experienced is an important state investment. Minnesota Philanthropy has stepped up and given more during the pandemic, but the magnitude of the challenge cannot be tackled by philanthropy alone. A one-time state nonprofit relief program is needed, and we are disappointed that it was not included in this bill. It was part of the governor's recommendation, and it has been introduced by Representative Hollins and Representative Moran in House File 4749. So we'd be happy to work with the committee on this, and we'd really like to encourage this inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thanks for the chance to testify today.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate the work being done by nonprofits. They have been really instrumental for the work that is being done. More than 10% of employees in the state of Minnesota work for nonprofits. My quick question is, I know the ARPA funds, the federal funds, the top category lists nonprofit. Were there any funds that were located through the ARPA funds, or was there any compensation to provide any support to the nonprofits through the federal funds? Ms. Ellis.
Yes and no. Like you said, the ARPA funds, it's very clear in the in Treasury's regulations that they can go directly to nonprofits. They can be used for that purpose. And there certainly was talk at the federal level about making programs specifically for nonprofits. Senator Klobuchar has the Work Now Act. I believe there are a few others as well, and none of them have gone through. Do you want to say anything about that?
That was all that I was going to say as well.
Any further questions or discussion from members? Seeing none, we'll look forward to making sure that we provide support, because this is only mostly what we're using is general revenue. Nothing in the bill uses the federal funds. So there's more conversation that needs to be happening, and we'll continue to find pathways to support based on the guidance that we have from the ARPA funds, how it can be used. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Members, any discussion?
In general, Mr. Chairman?
In general, because this, we're done with testimony from the public.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Lead Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I don't know if my question was clear when I was remote, so I wanted to come over and ask it again. So if we could have the fiscal analyst. My question is this, Mr. Chairman. It was around the total budget, I believe, for this committee for DEED for fiscal year 2022 was $294 million, and 23 was $130 million. And then is this an additional $180 million to that budget? That was my question, the DE amendment.
So the DE amendment focuses on a budget that we can work with as a committee so that we can put those issues that have been put forward by the members. So this is our proposal of spending some of the surplus that we have had from many people asking us to make sure that we invest in Minnesotans when it comes to childcare, when it comes to workforce, when it comes to supporting small businesses.
And Mr. Chairman.
Lead Hamilton.
And Mr. Chairman, we did address some of that, not to this extent, right, but we did address some of that in last year's bill that we did pass and was sent to the governor. And so, again, this is another $180 million additional dollars to what we passed the last year. And that was my point, correct?
This is a budget that we're working with this year, yes. Although it's on a budget year, this is something that we feel comfortable moving forward in investing in Minnesotans.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions? Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I just wanted to maybe make a statement as well. Again, disappointed that some things didn't get in the bill. I know our dollars are limited. Certainly we'll be bringing you lots of ideas for the next meeting that we can have, and we'll try some amendment swings. And I, And you know, you've always been an open chair to listen and to look for other opportunities. I was surprised, I think, that the folks that brought the Cajug idea didn't have the money for the phlebotomy training. I think that was a really well thought through project. I know Mr. Harris talked about that a little bit today, and I know in my community that would make a difference. I think that we see that as a real plus. I know that the hospitality program that Mr. Wagsland had mentioned as well, extremely low cost, and to try to bring up the industry that was by far most affected, and we tried to do it in a really smart, low-cost manner that, in fact, in every committee stop that we went to, we got asked the question, but yeah, is this enough money? And we really thought it was. And so it's about as efficient as you can ever ask the industry to do its own program to start helping a pipeline, which for us in hospitality, we're years away from really kind of seeing some significant increases in trying to retain, hopefully, some workers. So I'm hoping that you'll be open. We'll put together some ideas. I know at least from my own work, and we have work to do. I know the bill's not done, and I know that you've got more to do, but we look forward to working with you more because, again, our workforce responsibility is important to find the right ideas with also getting out of the way for employers to do what they need to do. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you so much. Chair Dunn.
Thank you, Chair Noor. And first, I want to thank you for the bill. I think, actually, we can solve a lot of Minnesota's problems for relatively small amounts of money with bills like this. Because if we can work on things like closing the wealth gap between, bluntly, folks who look like me and folks who look like you, we can solve a whole bunch of the rest of the problems by themselves. Every one of us looks at it and goes, well, I wish there was a little something more here or a little something more there. I may be talking to you on the floor this afternoon. But I persist in a state of confusion. And we hear some members on the opposite side of the table telling us that the budget was set last year and there's no need for further spending. And then we hear other members of the party on the other side of the table telling us we need to spend more. And it's this perpetual state of confusion. We passed a budget last year, that's true. We passed a tax bill last year, that's true. We have long-standing policy in some areas. That's also true. So either we have the resources to invest in Minnesota and make a difference, or we don't. Or maybe let me put it this way. I think we can all agree we have the resources. The question is whether we have the political will to invest in a better Minnesota. And I just, in this perpetual state of confusion around that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much, Chair Dudney. Representative Frankie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just gonna make a brief statement and just be done. I guess I don't get perplexed because I don't look at it as a one side versus the other. We're all individuals. We all represent our own districts, our own views, and our own people. And we all have our own election certificates. So when it comes to party or this side or that side, I don't get confused because I address a person as a person. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Lynn Hamilton for remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There shouldn't be any confusion. I was just pointing out a fact. We did pass a budget last year, and I rolled out what those numbers were last year for the biennium budget, and then I made a statement that this is another $180 million in addition to that. So there shouldn't be any confusion around that.
Well, I really appreciate the robust conversation. It's going to be lively on Wednesday when we go through this process. I ask for your support, and hopefully we'll send the bill to the floor and support small businesses and support many folks who've been left out. So thank you so much. With no further agenda items on the list, on the agenda, we are adjourned.